Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the major issues affecting this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of hope. I'm Rory Hearn, and joined today by my co-host, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you?
How you doing, Rory? Lovely day out there again.
It is indeed, it is indeed. And we're joined today, absolutely delighted to be joined by Amory O'Reilly, the policy officer with Threshold, and Marcella Stakem, social policy development officer with St. Vincent de Paul. Marcella, Amory, thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
It's a bit of Attack of the Badlands, isn't it? You're both Midlands.
Yes.
So we won't hold that against you.
Thanks very much.
Amory, you're from?
Westmead.
Westmead and?
Longford.
Longford. Well, it's great to get people from outside Dublin, because I'm originally from Waterford, even though I've been living in Dublin longer now than I live in Waterford, but always a proud culture. Martin, on the other hand, is a Dublin emigrant in Ashburn, isn't that right?
Yeah, for my sins.
For his sins.
Shoved out into the sticks.
Yeah. So it's great, great. Listen, we're involved in or researched and authored a report on the housing assistance payment, which was just published yesterday. And the housing assistance payment is become a really important central part to housing policy in Ireland. So what we're going to talk about is around kind of your findings in the report and also the implications for housing policy. And in particularly, also like to talk a little bit about kind of the private rental sector and the changes that are needed in that and solutions around how do we think we can solve this housing crisis. So in terms of the first question, the housing assistance payment, what is it?
Well, I suppose in its most simplest form, it's a form of social housing support for tenants that want or that need to access the private rental accommodation, and the payment support comes from local authorities.
And in terms of how many kind of households, tenancies are involved?
So there's over 83,000, it's over 40, about 44,000 at present. And under Rebuilding Ireland, there'll be about 83,000 in total households that are housed through HAP. And the council will deem their social housing need to be met once they're in a HAP property.
That's right, yeah.
So, and that's over 60% of the total social housing provision under Rebuilding Ireland. So it's quite a substantial amount.
Yeah, HAP is kind of the key social housing provision, the way social housing has been provided at the moment.
Yes, Like what we would like to see is, I suppose, a more of a move away from that type of model, and more building of local authority housing. That actually was, I suppose, one of our overall recommendations in the HAP report, that HAP is providing an important form of social housing support at the moment, but what we really need is more building, and building by local authorities.
And in terms of, you did research around this, you did a survey, is that right? How many people were, maybe you could talk through, like, what was the survey and what were sort of the responses from that?
Yeah, so what happened was actually, Threshold, we had done our own survey earlier in the year, and around the same time, Marcella and Spence DePaul was doing her own piece of research among the members. And it was when we spoke, we found out that we'd come to very similar conclusions and had very similar findings. And that's when we brought it together. So the survey element, that was a piece that I had done earlier this year, and we had 116 respondents altogether, and 23 of those were eligible for HAP but not yet in receipt, and the rest were receiving HAP. So what we found was that almost half of those people were paying top-ups on their HAP. So for people who may not understand how HAP works, the council pays the entire rent directly to the landlord, and then the tenant pays a differential rent, that's it, yeah, to the council, the same way as somebody in a council house would. But in some cases, the payment by HAP to the landlord wasn't enough to cover the rent, so the tenant would end up paying an extra amount of money directly to the landlord. And what we found is about half were paying this extra amount of money to the landlord, and 30% were paying more than 30% of their income on rent. And some people were paying over €500 a month in the form of a top-up to their landlord to try and keep the roof over their head. So top-ups had been a form of rents, had been common for rent supplement tenants, and HAP was meant to get rid of that. But it looks like it's just become another feature of HAP. And HAP caps were set in July 2016, and rents increased more than 20% since then, and the caps have remained the same. So that was one of the key findings from it, is that people are paying these top-ups. The caps just aren't cutting it.
Yeah. So yeah, that's where St Vincent de Paul would come into the picture a little bit, in that members that visit people in their homes, top-ups, they would say, has just become a common feature. They go into a home and they may be asked to come in to help maybe with food or help with utility bills or childcare costs, that type of thing. But when they delve a little bit deeper why they're there, it is actually because a tenant is trying their best to pay this top-up, and, you know, other bills are, you know, becoming, it's becoming a more of an issue for them to try and pay those other bills while they try and keep that top-up paid. Yeah, and it's causing really, you know, so much stress, financial stress and just overall stress for households.
Is the top-up policy within the county councils, or is it something that's sort of done under the table?
So, it's an unwritten policy. So each local authority has a different rental scheme. So in DCC, for example, it's about 15% of your net income you're going to pay. In South Dublin, it's about 10. In other places, it's 13. I think it's higher in Dunleary.
This is the differential rent. This is the rent you pay for whether you're supposedly as a proportion of your HAP rent or as a local authority.
Yeah. So when you go to the council, then go, right, I found this place, it's this amount of money here, and they calculate how much you're entitled to and then how much you have to pay them. If you do have to pay a bit extra to the landlord, you're not meant to end up paying more than 30% of your income in rent. And the council will apply kind of an affordability test on your income for that property. But that's just a practice. It's not a written policy. And in fact, only today, someone came to us to say, oh, that we don't do that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen in our council. No. Whereas people in other local authorities say, oh, yeah, well, look, it's about 30%. So it's an unwritten rule.
Yeah. And we found that very interesting. Like, that was kind of the first time that we heard about this 30% rule. Where that information came from, we found it very difficult to backtrack and actually find out where that is.
Yeah.
And the same with the 20% uplift. We found that, you know, some local authorities.
So explain what the 20% uplift is now.
The 20% uplift is where, if you are on a HAP payment and the rent that you're paying is higher than the HAP limit.
Yeah,
the local authority has discretion to increase that HAP payment by 20% to the landlord to ensure, you know, that you're not at risk of homelessness. But what we found, which we found was a really interesting, but concerning point, is that some local authorities are applying it, others aren't. And we found some cases where a tenant may be getting the 20% uplift in one tenancy. They would have had to leave maybe because the landlord was selling. They went to another tenancy with almost the same circumstances, same rent. Their circumstances hadn't changed, but they didn't receive the 20% uplift.
Mm.
And they weren't sure why this was happening. But like, I suppose the end result was they were really at a risk of homelessness because of that, not getting that 20% uplift. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose when you think about it, that it's quite a complex system, and that you're talking about the state is essentially what it's doing is going out to the private rental market and trying to get social housing from it.
Yeah.
And the way it's doing, because people are in such housing distress, you have, I think now it's like a third of all tenancies in the private rented sector are some form of subsidised under the rental accommodation scheme, HAP, or rent supplement. So surely, like you're saying now, almost 50,000 tenancies.
Yeah.
There is about 300,000-ish tenancies in the private rental sector. That's a sixth, roughly, if my maths is probably wrong, but That's a very significant proportion. So landlords must be looking at this and going, well, we know they can get a 20% extra on this. Mm-hmm. We know they can pay top-ups.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, the limits are really not relevant to them. They'll try and charge as much as they can.
Well, yeah, that's, I suppose, why we come up with our overall recommendation. Apart from more building, our overall recommendation for HAP is to review HAP in its entirety.
Mm.
Because what we found was, HAP is there and it's an important social housing support, but there's, I suppose, little awareness that HAP has to work in conjunction with the private rented sector.
Yeah.
They can't be, you know, HAP on this hand and the private rented sector over here and not identifying that the two of them need to work together to actually work. So that's why we, you know, that was our overall recommendation, if that makes sense, because we need the two of them to be working well, you know, to house, as you say, almost 50,000 people at the moment.
Households. We don't know in terms of people. Then
that's much
probably
higher.
Over 100,000 people in Brinbin House through it. Mm. Which again, if HAP didn't exist, you know, the housing crisis would be much, much worse, which is...
Well, not really, because they're not new houses. It's not like there's been nearly 50,000 new homes created. The vast majority of those people were on rent supplement and transitioned to HAP. So it's not an addition to the housing stock, really. They've just changed the way in which they're supported. And more people can avail of HAP than could avail a rent supplement as well. Hmm. So it's not really...
So how did the... Because I don't have those figures off the top of my head, but I remember looking when I was researching this, that there is households who are, you're right, transferring from rent supplement onto HAP, because they can work and it's a better system in that way. But then there's also additional tenancies, which are new tenancies that people come in on HAP. How does the 50,000 roughly break down? Do you know?
I actually don't know.
Yes, I don't know.
We don't know. But it's there's definitely been some new tenancies. But I think the idea of it being promoted as we've, you know, as they do, the government does every year in their housing figures, say we've provided an additional 20,000 social housing units. The majority of them are HAP. And what you're saying actually then as well is a lot of the HAP are just simply one scheme to another. So they're not even new tenancies.
Yeah. So certainly people who weren't on rent supplement who can now avail of HAP is certainly a huge... support to them.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't run it down in that way. But yeah, they're certainly not new homes.
Yes.
By any means.
And that's an important point to make.
Yeah. I suppose we shouldn't lose sight of the other issues of within HAP too. Like what we found, the standards within some HAP properties is also causing, you know, a lot of distress and frustration for tenants. For example, like 55% of the private rented accommodation has BER ratings of between D and G. And so that's not really taken into account, you know, when we talk about HAP, like HAP caps and the HAP limits and all of those top-ups, they're all really important aspects that need to be addressed. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of, you know, the standards within private accommodation, because we would have some members that are visiting... you know, really vulnerable and marginalised people in their homes. And, you know, the state of that property, like there's damp, there's mould, there's overcrowding. All of those issues are contributing to physical and mental health difficulties. And it's very difficult then, I think, too, I suppose we don't take into account how a person progresses on in life if they don't have, you know, a feeling of security and, you know, a feeling of this is my safe space. If you can't even live, you know, in a secure, warm, comfortable home.
Yeah, and I was quite struck by one of the figures he gave in the report around, I don't know if you have it to hand, but I was looking at it in terms of the assessments of private rental properties.
And
I have it here, yes, that... said local authorities, there's no single database for it. This is when local authorities assess standards in the private rented sector. And we know, you know, as you've talked about, there's massive issues of quality, you know, that, and when, it's a big issue in housing that we talk about the numbers that have been delivered but we don't talk about, as Orla Hegarty mentioned, the quality of those, which you're talking about that.
Yeah.
In 2017, only 16,000 private rented properties, which is about 4.5%, you say, were registered with the RTB, were inspected, that is by local authorities, and 12,000 of that 16,000 failed.
Actually
failed to meet the regulatory requirements of standards. But a notice to landlord was issued in respect of only 4.5% of that number, and only 5 cases of legal action were taken, and no action was taken in regard to the remaining 12,000 dwellings, leaving the tenants in substandard accommodation.
And that was an improvement on 2016.
Yeah, and there's a couple of issues going on there. What we found is that local authorities are not inspecting properties. The second issue, which has lost, I've lost what my second issue was, but the standards. There is no mechanism there to see how many properties really is being inspected, because there is no single database. So, you know, to get that those statistics there,
yeah,
you have to delve through all local authorities' records.
Yeah.
So really, that could be something that could be addressed quite easily, I think, you know, and that there should be one database there for that local authorities feed into.
Yeah.
And also it's very difficult actually for the local authorities to get the landlords to do the work. So I suppose in a previous life, I would have worked with people who were moving into HAP properties and would have supported them sometimes when there was issues with the standards. And the EHO may come out, the EHO may send
the environmental health officer.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yeah. May send an instruction to the landlord and they're given a certain number of months to do it. I'm going to do that now. And a bit is done here and a bit is done there. And the EHO comes back out. Oh, they're doing some, but okay, we'll come back out in another few months, and it drags on and it drags on. And while maybe on paper it's 4 or 6 months, that's 4 or 6 months of a person living in that. And certainly the case I'm thinking of, it wasn't a great place to begin with. And that can really weigh heavy on people, as Marcella said, physical health, but also their mental health. But for the local authority to really force a landlord to carry out the work, it appears that it's very difficult for them to do it, or they don't have the drive to do it. Because as you see, there was only 5 cases of legal action taken, but yet we know that thousands of properties just weren't up to scratch and nothing was done about it. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be, I suppose, within the local authorities needs to be reflection on, well, how do we make this better?
You mentioned density and the amount of people living in houses, and I've read anecdotally that number has, it is back to where we were in the bad old days of people squashed into houses, that we have never been more crowded in homes. Have you found any evidence of that in your research?
Maybe. I suppose we don't have any statistics as such, but that would be what was coming back to ourselves through our members. And I'm sure Anne-Marie, through the threshold advisors, would hear that, you know, overcrowding is a real issue. Actually, our chairperson of the Social Justice Committee spoke yesterday, and he made a really valid point that St Vincent de Paul is 175 years in existence here in Ireland. And the issues back then are quite similar to the issues now as regards housing. As he said, we have cracked some of the issues, but we certainly haven't cracked the housing crisis or the housing issue. And overcrowding was one of those issues back then. And we're looking at it, you know, it's never gone away. Yeah.
And that's interesting, you know, in terms of that real life experience, because we hear, you know, a lot again about numbers in the housing crisis. But maybe you could give some of those examples in terms of coming back to you within St. Vincent de Paul of, you know, what sort of situations people are in and are facing.
Yeah.
In terms of housing distress. And
I think it's just insurmountable stress and financial worry. I suppose we don't take into account, too, that St Vincent de Paul members would work with vulnerable, marginalised, low-income families that are not going to have the confidence or the self-esteem to, you know, ask a landlord or request a landlord, you know, to bring a building up to standard to make it, you know, fit for their use. There's all those types of issues that, you know, HAP doesn't address, and HAP doesn't take into account that, you know, we're talking about people that are in very vulnerable positions, and we're really asking them to do something they're just not able to do. And that's possibly because of their low income or low educational skills or just poor mental health.
Sorry, Anne-Marie.
I was just going to say, and in threshold, what we find now is, so standards have always been one of the top issues brought to us by tenants. And if you look at our figures, it looks like it's dropped off ever so slightly. But if you look a bit closer, what we can see is that people still do have issues with the standards in their home, but they're too frightened to say anything in case they lose their home, or they're battling a rent increase or notice of termination. So tackling the standards that's down the list. So people just are living in those situations, and they feel that they can't challenge it because they've nowhere to go.
Yeah. The one member gave us a really good, you know, example of a family that they're supporting. It's a lone parent, which would make up about 60% of the population that SVP members would support. She's a lone parent woman with one child, teenage child, has additional special needs. She's living in a house that has no heat, is stamped throughout. She has an alleyway really for a kitchen, so there's no sitting area, barely enough place to eat. And she asked her landlord to fix the heat. So he put in a heater in the kitchen, but put up the rent as a result. So that's where we're at with, you know, the standards and what people are facing with. Mm-hmm. So she's not only, you know, paying a high rent, she's also paying a top up on that property. And when she did, you know, get the confidence to ask her landlord to put in, you know, heat, he put up the heat or put up the rent as a result. So it's those types of case studies where I suppose we're not, you know, the department, I suppose, is not really hearing or doesn't maybe understand fully what people are faced with in the private rented sector.
Anne-Marie, did you want to come in? Martin, you wanted to...
I think you're very generous in saying they're not hearing or don't understand. I think you're very, very generous in that assessment. I think it would be impossible for anybody in this country not to understand that the standard of housing in the private rented sector is atrocious. It's absolutely atrocious. The figures show it. The empirical data is there. So, I mean, if the government don't know, it's because they don't want to know.
Well, we, you know, had lots of discussions before this ever went to print, this document. And as I said, I suppose that was our overall recommendation, is a review of HAP, because we want the department to do something about it. It's OK for us to write about it, but we want the department to write about it and see those things. And yeah, possibly the see them already, but while it's not in writing, I think it doesn't get done. So we want the department to put it in writing and make up their own recommendations around standards and rent caps and all the various issues within HAP.
And is there a danger in this? And, you know, I've talked about it before, that the real danger in this policy, or the problem with it, is that you become dependent. Your social housing policy becomes dependent on landlords and the private market. And so therefore, even if the department might say, yeah, actually, we do want, which they do really want, better standards, they're not willing, and local authorities the same, they're not willing to go out and enforce that. Mm-hmm. Because if they force that, then landlords will say, well, we're not going to get into the HAP because it means we have to provide proper quality accommodation. I've got lots of people lined up outside my, potentially outside my flat or my house, who will take it, and I don't have to make any change, and they'll pay it. And that... So there's a huge power imbalance, that we've handed all the power over to the private landlords in terms of housing provision.
Yeah. And landlords know that. Yeah. They certainly do know that.
I suppose we'd be a little bit fairer to landlords. And I suppose recent cases that's come our way, that members have come with just out of sheer frustration. As policy officers, we don't really deal with individual cases. We just don't have the capacity within our organisation. But members have become more and more coming to us and saying, please help. What would we do here? Because there's someone, you know, at real risk, like, and as in someone that could be a two parent family with 5, 6, 7 children in one case that's come into my mind. And I actually had sympathy for the landlord in some of the cases, because the families that I'm thinking of got into rent difficulty because of the rent, because of rent arrears on the differential rent and in another case on the top up. And it was the landlord that was losing out, as well as the family being at real risk of eviction. The landlord wasn't having his mortgage paid either. And so SVP members stepped into that breach to try and hold that tenancy until something was sorted out with
this,
the department.
This is because with the HAP scheme, if the tenant goes into arrears, the landlord isn't paid the money from the department.
Yeah.
So therefore, you're right. Yes, the landlord, in a sense, takes that hit. And so so you could see that situation. By me saying we've handed over the power over all the landlords, I'm not saying all landlords then are straight away going to manipulate it. Mm. But we know there's a lot of landlords who are seeing the opportunity to make hugely increase the rents. We also know that a lot of landlords, there's 20,000 of them, are in mortgage arrears. So they see the opportunity to try and get rid of their property. Mm. But the overall problem is, when you hand it over to the private sector with all its, you know, inefficiencies, inequalities, that this is what happens.
We'll have to start a hashtag not on all landlords. I think we're going to have to.
Well, the department knows this as well.
I knew one landlord who was nice once, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, look, we know the answer. The answer is not back on landlords or the private rented sector. The answer has to be back on local authorities to build social homes. And I suppose as many people in this sector, you know, has said and advocated really articulately, you know, really well, we've managed to do it in the 40s and the 50s. You know, build good quality social homes. So why can we not do it now? Why not, you know, and that the department will come back and say, yes, we are doing it.
Mm.
Well, yes, we may, but we are certainly not doing it on the level that we need.
Mm-hmm. And in before we come back onto that, because the issue is that I know you make in the report is that, you know, okay, there's problems with it, but it's housing 50,000 households and that's not going to change in the short term, at least. So the question is, well, how do you make HAP work in the short term? And one of the issues you've recommended is the issue of security of tenure.
Yes.
Because everybody who's in a HAP tenancy, they have, as you said, their social housing needs met. So they're supposedly in social housing, which under government policy and under international policy, social housing is supposed to, and all housing is supposed to provide security of tenure. Mm-hmm. But that's not provided in HAP tenancies. They're, you know, and in some ways you're saying even more vulnerable to eviction because of the gap between limits and rents. But that issue, Amri, maybe you talk a little bit about that whole issue of insecurity of tenure and...
Yeah, so under the Residential Tenancies Act, you can be, the landlord can legitimately end the tenancy if they want to sell, if they need to move in or a family member needs to move in, they're going to renovate, or on grounds of 34B, which essentially is your Part 4 tenancy, which is a 6-year tenancy, has come to an end and the landlord just wants a change.
Yeah.
And gives you a notice on grounds 34B and you're on your way.
And they can also serve a notice to quit within the first 6 months.
Oh, no, that's gone.
That's gone now. Is it okay? Well, you can tell us those changes.
Yeah. Well, that's been gone a while.
Okay.
So they could, a tenant, and those are all no-fault evictions. The tenant wouldn't have done anything amiss or awry in those scenarios, and the tenancy can just be ended. So there's no security of tenure really in HAP as social housing. And when most people think about social housing, they think about a home for life. And if you move into a council property, which isn't governed by the Residential Tenancies Act, you're only really going to be evicted for severe antisocial behaviour. And even at that, it's a long process to get there because there'll be the engagement with the local housing officer and possibly the welfare officer of the council as well. Whereas a HAP tenant can just be out, and because there's so few properties, and particularly properties within the cap, and landlords willing to take it, you are at a very real risk of homelessness.
Yeah. Anne-Marie actually done a really good chart on page 16 of the report. So a local authority tenant, a one bedroom single person on social welfare would be paying, total rent would be €30. On a HAP tenancy is actually €151.15 total rent.
Mm.
So €30 versus €151.15.
And
so
you could be evicted tomorrow.
A lot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there's huge inequality between them, both housing tenures.
I know Tony's not here, but I can hear his voice in my head. And we must mention is that HAP is actually the least fiscally responsible way to provide social housing. And I have to say that because Tony will kill me if I don't.
Yeah. A person at the event yesterday said, we've legitimised top-ups with HAP. So with rent supplement, they were there, but, you know, they shouldn't have been happening. But now we've allowed them to happen with HAP and we've kind of legitimised them.
Mm-hmm. And what that means is that, and the problem would happen in the perspective of, as Martin talked about, fiscal responsibility, but value for money, is that it's going to constantly chase ever higher rents.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's right to demand the caps should be raised so that people can afford it. But that's the cycle you're in.
Yeah.
You're in a cycle of chasing ever increasing rents. And the investment that goes into HAP is housing somebody. But the investment is lost. It's not actually investment in social housing.
No, not at all.
Yeah, we have it in a paragraph in the report. It comes from an absence of rights, homeless families and social housing marketisation in Ireland. And in that, the Rillands, we quoted Rillands saying the financing of a direct build social housing unit in Dublin through state borrowing will cost approximately 800 per month. In contrast, the monthly repayment for a HAP unit in Dublin is 1,244. So this means financing a HAP unit in Dublin is 5,328 euro more expensive to the state per annum than a new build unit.
Well, that's a stunning figure. It's almost twice as expensive to use HAP than to build social housing. It's For a government that prides itself on the moniker of fiscal responsibility, it is the least fiscally responsible way to address social housing. Mm-hmm. And there can't be any doubt about that.
And the department has, there was quite a number of changes to legislation recently to tackle rents and to enforce the rent pressure zones. And unfortunately, rents just keep going up, and I suppose the trick is to find a way of actually bringing them down, not just prevent them from going sky high, but start bringing them down. And one way to start bringing them down is with increased social housing provision, and that's one way of bringing the private market to heel without actually intervening in the market, because our government says they don't want to intervene too much in the market, but they've introduced some quite strict legislation to get landlords to adhere to rent pressure zones. But one way of doing it would be just build social housing. It's responsible. It's a state asset then. And it's less expensive than HAP.
Well, the HAP model is an upward-only rent model. It's your rent is only ever going to go up. Mm. And it's a guarantee to landlords of a minimum of a 4% increase per annum. It's an absolute gift.
But it also, I think, is a reflection of a change in Department of Housing and broader policy, which might be called neoliberal policy, in shifting away from seeing the state's responsibility and role of providing social housing for people for their life. Mm. That it's seen as this temporary measure. It's like a social welfare. It's a temporary support. Mm. It's viewed as, so HAP is viewed as, people will only need it for a short period of time. This is the approach. And we're not building homes for life, and this is more, as they say, economically efficient, but it's also their way of looking at people. They look, they only need social housing for a temporary period, and then they'll move out of it again. So we'll do HAP as our main, as our main housing policy, rather than seeing the lesson from the last 30 years of neoliberal marketized housing policies has been, again, you look at Austria, the most successful housing model, they build social housing for a range of incomes of people. Mm-hmm. They don't reduce it down. They don't just give subsidies to tenants. They build it. And this is where that's why HAP, I think, is so wrong and is so dangerous, because it moves us away from that other model, which actually provides sustainable housing.
You know, if it's seen by the department and by government as a short-term housing support, in that short term, I think families and households need support within that short term. So one of our recommendations was a protocol similar to the interim tenancy support protocol that's completed by Threshold with the rent supplement, that we need something like that for the housing assistance payment. So to, you know, prevent people becoming homeless and really as just that support, that there's a phone line that you can pick up on and say, look, I'm having this difficulty with my HAP tenancy. What should I do? Mm-hmm. At the moment, there is nothing, you know, really there in place. Like, so again, we're not really looking at the realities. There's, you know, many, many issues there, but we're not really addressing them on a practical level as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the interim tenancy sustainment protocol, Threshold operate that in conjunction with the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection and the DRHE. So if someone's rent goes up above the rent supplement cap, we assist them. Well, first of all, we contact the landlord. We'll see if the rent increase is legal, negotiate. And then if the rent has to go up, we'll look for an uplift in the rent supplement from the DSP. And now as everyone moves over to HAP, we're seeing there's a need for that with HAP as well. And because there's such inconsistency between between and within local authorities to award the 20% uplift. We feel that formal protocol is required. But in addition to that, we give support to the tenants as well. So if they are having other issues or difficulties, we'll offer that support. And as I mentioned a little while ago about the local area officers for council tenants. Council tenants have a local area officer if they are having difficulties or issues, where a HAP tenant doesn't have that either. So they're missing another piece of that social housing provision, you know, the security, the affordability, and then the bit of support that comes with it.
Yeah, and speaking on behalf of like members in St Vincent de Paul, I think they would find that very helpful and useful, because what we're finding is they're picking up the slack in a lot of cases. Like they're going into a household and they are becoming, or they're trying their level best to nearly become experts in housing assistance payment to support and help a family. And so that's causing, you know, a lot of extra workload on a volunteer, really, because that is what they are. They're volunteers.
And in terms of the St. Vincent de Paul kind of research that you got back, and in terms of threshold as well, how is this across the country? Is it principally Dublin and the big cities, or are you seeing this, or even...
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere, yeah. In the Republic of Ireland, SVP have over 1,000 conferences. And within every one of those conferences, if there is a HAP tenancy, St Vincent de Paul are supporting them in the form of helping with utility bills, education costs, helping with childcare costs. And when you pair it back, it is because they are in a HAP tenancy and they're paying really, you know, a substantial amount of money out of their low incomes. That's those that are working and those are not working. So it doesn't really matter, even if you are working, the top up that you're paying is still the, you know, that piece that is causing such difficulty. Mm-hmm. Like the threshold survey showed that on average, people are paying €177 per month on top of their differential payment. And when you take into account all the other bills that come into a household, that is, it's not an insignificant, you know, amount of money for any household.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when you consider that HAP is a direct payment from the state to landlords, but then people who are in receipt of social welfare are also now giving a percentage of their social welfare straight to landlords. I mean, the game is it's a good game to be in if you're a landlord.
Yeah, I suppose if you're a landlord who doesn't have a mortgage and you've got a couple of properties on the go, yeah, you could do quite well for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I suppose anecdotally, I would hear of landlords who do have quite a few properties have taken HAP tenants on, and they'll call the shots with the HAP section or the council as to what they want and who they want and all of that.
Have you come across people becoming homeless from HAP tenancies?
Not in our survey. I haven't.
Well, I do. I have. Yeah. I actually have.
Yeah. No, I've heard it too.
Yeah, no, yeah. I've come across people who've become homeless straight from a HAP tenancy. Mm-hmm. I know it's anecdotal. I know, again, this is anecdotal, where one tenant had convinced the landlord to go with HAP. Landlord went with HAP, and HAP is, you sign up for 2 years as a landlord with HAP.
Well, not really.
Okay.
The tenant is required to stay in HAP property for two years.
That's
There's
right.
no obligation on the landlord to keep you.
Well, that was exactly it. So we'll say that was in April. In June of the same year, got the eviction notice saying that we won't be renewing at the end of the period. So that person was then evicted into homelessness.
Yeah.
Actually into homelessness. Mm-hmm. And I saw it with my own eyes, and I was kind of, I was very gobsmacked at the coldness of the particular council, the estate agent, and the landlord.
Yeah.
There was a total disregard, and that was a mother with children, left on the side of a road on a bank holiday weekend. And you're like, how can this happen in this country? How can, and it does happen. It absolutely does happen.
We've seen it, and it's that feeling of powerlessness for everybody, that there's actually nothing you can do. It's like seeing it happening in slow motion and not being able to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that feeling, I can only describe that. It must be so stressful and heartbreaking But yeah, and we've seen families becoming homeless for a second time. They've gone into a HAP tenancy. That HAP tenancy broke down because maybe the landlord was selling their property. They went into another HAP tenancy after maybe spending a little bit of time in a hotel or B&B. And then the same thing happened to them a second time round in the private rented sector. So then they're very, very fearful. Like, you know, what's the point? Like, should I just stay in a in the homeless accommodation until I get something that's more secure? Like, because, you know, at all times, any of the research that we've ever done, parents are always thinking about their children. Like, what's this going to do to my children? What's the effect there?
It's kind of a boomerang social housing policy in that you keep coming back. Your social housing needs, by definition, are not met. They are met for a month, 6 weeks, you know, maybe 6 months, maybe a year, but you are definitely going to be on that roundabout again. So it's not really meeting anybody's social housing needs in a permanent sense. It's basically taking you off a list for a little while, which you will then be back on that list again. I refer to it as 363-day nomads. We have created a country of people who are on 363-day contracts who have no idea where they're going to be at the end of the 363 days.
Yeah. This research that we conducted last year, Stories of Struggle, I think there's one quote that really sums it up. When a parent says, I can't plan, I can't save, I can't do anything until I get out of homeless accommodation. So that there is that feeling of powerlessness, but, you know, that person can't look beyond the next day. They can't look beyond, you know, and say next month I'm going to get back into education or I'm going to even begin my education journey. Everything is stalled.
And if you were a cynical sort of person, you would think it's purely a numbers game. It's a numbers game because the local authority waiting list number technically has gone down, but it's because a bunch of people are now on a waiting list or not on any list at all. Because you have to opt to go on the transfer list when you go on to HAP within 2 weeks. Now, some councils are more flexible than that with that than others. And actually, yesterday at the launch, one of the Dublin City councillors told us they've changed it in Dublin so that it's actually an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in. But yeah, if you were cynically minded, you would think it's just a nice numbers game. And like that, people remain on this treadmill, but they get categorised somewhere slightly different.
I'm just going to digress a little. There was a report really recently in RTE about gentrification. But HAP is actually resulting in gentrification in that it's moving people out of cities into more rural locations. And once they've moved to the rural location, it's then very hard to get back on the housing list for area that they want to be in.
Yes, definitely. That's actually something that our advisors in Galway brought up. So people who've been unable to find properties within Galway City are going outside the city. Fair enough. But, you know, their centre of interest, city, their community, their family, everything's in a city. And that's where most of us, you know, want to be. And that's where your supports are if things do go awry. But they move out of the city to find somewhere to live and they're being, the council is guaranteeing, don't worry, you'll be able to move back in. But there's no guarantee of that once you're gone out of an area for a certain length of time. And see, this is where it becomes quite a grey area with HAP and it being a form of social housing. Because if you're in a council property and for whatever reason you have to leave that through no fault of your own, the council are obliged to house you elsewhere. And even if they have to move you to the far side of the country for whatever reason, they still have to bring you back and put you in a home in the area you're from. But what happens, that all gets blurred, very much blurred, and people could find themselves isolated or having to start all over again until that landlord decides maybe they're selling the house and they don't want you.
And you're also talking about very vulnerable and maybe marginalised people to begin with. So in our previous work and then, you know, our work, with my work within St Vincent de Paul, we are talking about people that have, you know, well, would be classed as vulnerable and marginalised, whether they be like travellers or lone parents or people with disabilities or people that are already homeless. So, you know, those factors, I think, those issues have to be taken into account. Like, I think we're setting up people to find a HAP tenancy, negotiate that tenancy with a landlord, keep that tenancy, even though the limits and the caps and the top-ups and all that is factored in there. But we're not actually taking into account the person.
Mm. Yeah, it's the individualisation of responsibility under the neoliberal welfare state.
I just summed it up very quickly.
But it's in terms of changes then, I was starting to get onto it, the private rental sector, what needs to change around the legislation to get security of tenure that people can have homes in the private rental sector?
So we see it quite simply. We need to get rid of Section 34B, and that's the section that allows a landlord to end a tenancy when the Part 4 tenancy is coming toward an end. So that's nowadays that'd be anyone who moves into a property now is technically entitled to remain in that property for 6 years unless they breach their responsibilities as a tenant or the landlord wants to sell, renovate, family member move in. However, at the end of the 6 year term, the landlord can just end it because they want to end it. So we need to remove 34B, and what that will do is result in indefinite tenancies. So that's one aspect, and we need long term leases. So, and there needs to be a promotion of that and encouragement for that. So a tenant can sign up 10 years, long-term lease. Now with that comes another, maybe additional responsibilities than what you'd have as a regular tenant, but you also have greater ownership and control over that space as your home. And you can't be evicted from it on grounds of sale, renovation and so on and so forth. And as more people, like there are people now who are in their 30s living in apartments with children who are unlikely to ever buy, unlikely to ever get a house with the council, they'll have to rent and they'll need that level of security and autonomy in their home to create a solid foundation for them and their children. So we need to see long-term leasing. Ideally, we'd like to see a situation where a landlord doesn't evict because they want to sell. It's commonplace throughout Europe for a landlord to sell with a tenant in situ. There is a belief that selling with a tenant in situ in Ireland will result in the selling price being 20% less than what you get with a vacant property. Now, I've not been able to find the actual numbers on that, but that's the widely held belief anyway, that's you'd be selling at a discount with a tenant in situ. But we'd like to see a situation where that doesn't have to happen, where the tenant can remain a new landlord buy. Now, because there's such a shortage of housing at the moment, everyone competing together. So you've got, you know, people who want to buy for the first time, maybe second time buyers who are coming out of negative equity. And now you have the institutional investors coming in. And then you've got, of course, the local authority and the AHBs buying. So everyone's kind of competing. And I suppose institutional investors aren't buying one-off properties here and there. It's more than likely going to be just a regular person who wants to buy that property. So if the landlord doesn't get to evict, who's going to buy that? Is it going to be another landlord? So that it is problematic. I suppose, have a nice, pure, tidy solution to that one. But getting to a point where you can sell with a tenant in situ would be ideal. Being allowed to evict on grounds of renovation, that's been strengthened in the most recent piece of legislation, the Residential Tenancies Amendment Act 2019. So previously, a landlord could evict because they're planning to do some refurbishment work. But now a set of criteria have been put in the legislation. And so the renovation work has to meet those before a landlord can evict on grounds of renovation. And they're pretty robust pieces. And what's going to be key though is that they're enforced.
Yeah.
If a landlord's sort of, you know, claims he's doing or she's doing A, B, C, and D, and doesn't do it, that there'd be some.
Which comes back to what we said earlier: the lack of the lack of resources, lack of regulation and enforcement. That you can have great legislation, but if it's not enforced, it's meaningless.
Well, this is where we'll see where the RTB's inspection and sanction regime comes into play. So that's just up and running as of last week. So they have hired authorised officers who will be able. So if the RTB becomes aware of certain breaches, so for example, if a landlord breaches the rent pressure zone legislation, there's a few other ones, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, they can set about investigating that breach. And if on the surface level, it looks like
a breach has occurred, an authorised officer will then go about carrying out an inspection. And they've got some considerable powers. They'll have warrants. They can, if they think that you have information relating to it, you have to answer their questions, and provide whatever information you have. And if they investigate and let's say the landlord goes, oh God, very sorry about that. Didn't realise. Terribly sorry. I'll sort it out now. It's grand. Fine. No harm, no foul. We're all okay. But if the landlord doesn't cooperate or continues to be in breach of the legislation, they can be sanctioned and a fine be placed upon them and that be done through the courts. So that's just started as of last week, and those officers should be in place to start investigating and enforcing. But we'll have to see how that plays out. And anybody can make the RTB aware of breaches, just in case anyone out there listening is interested. There is a form on their website. Now, obviously, they have to be legitimate. You can't be sending them in for the crack. But they will, if they become aware of something, they will look into it. Yeah.
But the foremost finding from your report is build. Build houses. Build houses and negate all of these other issues houses.
Build houses. And particularly for, you know, St. Vincent de Paul that are working with low income families, you know, we feel the way forward for those families to progress, you know, with having a home is only one aspect, I suppose, of your life. It's a very important aspect, but there's other aspects to your life. So, you know, attaining an education, progressing, you know, with the practicalities of life, they cannot, I suppose, be moved forward if you don't have a home. So, yes, we would say that, you know, build more social and affordable homes is the beginning and the end of it all, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose one recommendation that we didn't speak about, and it does cause a lot of frustrations and stress for people that are on HAP tenancies, is the practicalities around HAP that I suppose we don't take into account. And as policy workers or policy officers and policy makers, I suppose we don't look at them, I don't think, you know, in sufficient detail. I think we think about the bigger aspects, but, you know, the delays in application processes, the payment of rent and arrears, the application is, paying the rent the date the application is processed as opposed to the date the tenancy commenced. They're all practicalities that could be looked at right here and now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of the case studies that came back to us show that people are like, were really at severe risk of, you know, eviction before their even tenancy got to begin. Because a landlord was waiting for their money and didn't trust that their money was coming through. So, you know, they're obvious and they're practical things that could be looked at right now.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat with us, Rory.
Yeah, no, I thank Marcel and Anne-Marie. It's great work Threshold and St. Vincent de Paul are doing in this area. It's really, really important that we keep highlighting it, that we keep, you know, the focus on that, you know, the alternatives are there, very clearly set out what needs to be done. It's about keeping the pressure up. Thank you. And remember to.
Well, it is interesting that we've had two chats today, one with the people who design and one with the people who deal with the
end housing realities.
And that both have the same conclusion, that unless we start building adequate amounts of social housing, this is only going to get worse. Thank you very much for coming in. Folks, each pod relies on patrons. So please head to our website, www.tortoiseshack.ie, and sign up for as little as the price of a cup of coffee. Thanks very much.